from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's an American trend. The country has not been so locally inclined in what we eat, buy, and celebrate since maybe before the railroads or the interstate highways. My guests today say that local, locavore, if you will, movement is showing up in public policy and economic planning, too. Cities and towns and mayors are often the new drivers. How far can that go? This hour on Point, cities, towns, and local leaders, mayors, as the new pioneers of American problem-solving, policy-making. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you see it? Does it give you hope? What about its limits? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Jennifer Bradley, a fellow and senior advisor at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, co-author with Bruce Katz of The Metropolitan Revolution, How Cities and Metros Are Fixing Our Broken Politics and Fragile Economy. Jennifer Bradley, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
It's great to be here, Tom. Thanks for asking me to come on today.
Sure. And with us, Benjamin Barber, senior research scholar at the Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society in New York, author of the forthcoming book, If Mayors Ruled the World, Dysfunctional Nations, Rising Cities. Benjamin Barber, welcome.
Hello, Tom.
So here we are. We've got high-profile mayoral races all over the country, New York, Boston, Seattle, Houston, and many more. And the two of you coming in to say in different ways, from different angles, that this is kind of where it's happening these days. Jennifer, explain that for us. You know, we're so accustomed to these big trends being and big changes and movements in this country being driven by Washington, let's say. What makes you say that the action is at the local level?
When you look at what's happening in the country at large, you see that there are significant challenges facing the nation and metropolitan areas. We need more jobs post-recession. We need better jobs because we've got millions more people in poverty and near poverty. The issue is it's metropolitan areas, these collections and networks of cities, suburbs, small towns, and the political, civic, and business leaders in them who are best at coming up with solutions for their places. Washington is not coming to the rescue. Washington is mired in its own partisan gridlock and is unable to set the agenda. So mayors and university leaders, civic leaders, all the people who create these metropolitan area networks are saying, it's on us. We have to step up. And what my co-author Bruce Katz and I have seen when we're working on our book, The Metropolitan Revolution, is that places are rising to this challenge. New York, Denver, Houston, Portland, Northeast Ohio. We've seen all of these places say, all right, we know what we need to do to get our economy moving again, to put people back to work, and to move ahead and not wait for Washington.
I got all kinds of questions about that, but give us a couple, three hard examples of,
sure,
of significant steps that even with, you know, headwinds that may be global and national have made a difference on the back of local policy.
I'll start with one that was very mayoral driven. In New York City, after the 2008 crash, Mayor Bloomberg and his economic team understood that they really needed to reorient their economy away from such a dependence on the financial sector. So the mayor and the Economic Development Corporation reached out to 300 business leaders, more than two dozen community groups, and other networks of university leaders and said, if you could do one thing to change New York's economy, what would it be? And overwhelmingly, the answer they got back was, we need more tech talent. We need more high-level engineers because increasingly every company is having a technological component. So we need the people who can marry technology and media and technology in the fashion industry and technology in the medical industry. So the mayor and the Economic Development Corporation created this contest whereby universities all around the world competed for a chance to build an applied sciences graduate school in New York City. They ended up choosing three campuses. The city itself is spending about $130 million for infrastructure improvements on Roosevelt Island, downtown Brooklyn, and around one of the Columbia campuses. In return, they are going to see over the next 30 years billions of dollars, about $30 billion in new economic activity. They're going to see about 1,000 companies spun off. They're going to see about 48,000 jobs. And they're going to see a more diverse New York economy.
Is this nibbling at the edges of their economic challenges, or is this significant, profound even?
I think this is significant and profound because it's creating a pipeline, a kind of magnet for technology and technology talent. They're creating a strong cluster of applied sciences and engineering and city problem solving that I think will spin off all kinds of new industries. I think that New York will be able to position itself as the place that growing cities all across the globe come to and say, help us solve our problems. You, New York, understand how to move a lot of people, move a lot of water, move a lot of garbage, do all the things that large cities need to do. That's going to be increasingly in demand.
And that's just one city. We'll look right across the country. Benjamin Barber, your book is If Mayors Ruled the World. Do they have the power locally to really change the lives of citizens who live, we're told again and again, in a global economy and, for that matter, more and more a global culture, Benjamin?
Power is, of course, ultimately, Tom, a manifestation of capacity and ability to do things. And the difference between the federal government today and cities in the United States, and by the way, it's not just an American phenomenon, this is a global phenomenon with cities all over the world. The difference is that cities are pragmatic problem-solving operations, and they have to deal with the real issues of people. People look at Washington from the distance and watch the gridlock with amazement, awe, and a sense of also disappointment. Whereas in cities, you know, cities are where people are born, they work, they pray, they play, they grow up, they get old, they get sick, and they die. I mean, they are the places that define our lives, and mayors and city councils don't have the luxury of gridlock and not doing anything. Ultimately, you've got to keep the sewers working, you've got to pick up the garbage, you've got to keep the transport working, and as Jennifer just said, you have to transform an economy so that it works, so that there are jobs for the people who live there. So, in effect, cities are pragmatic because they have to be, because it's where people live, it's where problems have to get solved, and ideology and gridlock simply are not permissible in a place where if you don't solve problems, it's not just government that comes to a halt, but life that comes to a halt.
What's a great example you would point to, Benjamin Barber, that's somehow, you know, way beyond fixing potholes, of a city, town, mayor, like taking the bit in his or her teeth and really making a change? Let's hear it.
Well, climate change is probably a perfect example of both national and international gridlock. For 5 years since Copenhagen, we've watched nation states every year come together to try to update the Kyoto Protocol and go home saying that their sovereignty doesn't really permit them to do anything. While cities have been, over the last 5 years, and indeed over the last 20 years, been making direct progress on curbing carbon emissions. 80% of carbon emissions come from cities, which means not only that cities have a pragmatic interest in doing carbon reduction, but actually have the capacity to impact it. And to just give you a couple of quick examples, in Los Angeles, it turns out that it's not the freeways, but the port that's responsible for nearly half of the carbon emissions. And Mayor Villaraigosa, over the last 6-7 years, he just was finished his term, greened up the port by electrifying the ships so that when the container ships sit at anchor, like the yachts in the Mediterranean, they are now hooked up to electricity. Their diesel engines don't idle for days and days.
Yep.
Trucks that come in 12,000 a day are hybrided.
So that's a big deal right there in L.A. But we always think in climate terms, for that matter, economic terms. I mean, talk about Wall Street. Jennifer raises it in New York. They've been watching like crazy the Federal Reserve Bank and the federal government. First, it was stimulus plans and then all the money that the Fed has pumped into the national economy. And you've seen this, Benjamin. They're on the edge of their seats on Wall Street, whether they're going to, you know, pull this back in. We got Paul Krugman saying, don't ramp it down. We need that. That is so national. I mean, what is the strength of a mayor in the face of whether or not the Fed's going to point, push $80 billion a month into the economy.
Los Angeles cut one half of its port emissions, which reduced carbon in Los Angeles by about 20%. That's a phenomenal success rate comparing to what nation states are doing. New York did it by insulating housing better and with a new LEED program, being sure that both new housing and old business and residential housing was better insulated because a lot of our energy is squandered away. The point is, the most urgent problem facing the globe is climate change. Cities are making a difference despite the do-nothing states that have not been cooperating.
And on the economic front, Jennifer, if the Fed dials back everything, does that overwhelm mayors' efforts to bolster or their city or town economy?
No, and I think as Benjamin was saying so cogently, that actually makes them have to redouble their efforts. There's nobody that they can kick the can down the road to. They're the end of the road. They're the end of the line. I don't think that Benjamin or I are saying that the federal government is irrelevant or unimportant.
Mm-hmm.
What we're saying is that when it comes to creating jobs, when push comes to shove, it's mayors and networks of city and metropolitan leaders who are getting the job done and actually translating federal action into real jobs for real people in their communities.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about cities, towns, and mayors as the new pioneers of American public policy and beyond this country, say our guests, shaping, reshaping how we live and doing it locally. Jennifer Bradley is with us, co-author of The Metropolitan Revolution, How Cities and Metros Are Fixing Our Broken Politics. We'll look at that. And Fragile Economy, excerpt at our website. Benjamin Barber is with us. His forthcoming book is If Mayors Ruled the World, Dysfunctional Nations, Rising Cities. You can hear the sound of it in many quarters. This was in March of this year. A state Supreme Court struck down New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's initiative to limit serving sizes of sugary drinks. But he said, look, we've got a history of decisions made here in New York really having effects that he was proud of.
Throughout its history, the New York City Board of Health has taken bold action to confront many public health problems. It banned lead paint. It required fluoride to be included in drinking water, and it required calorie counts to be included on the menus of chain restaurants. In each of these cases, the federal government later followed the Board of Health's example. Our Board of Health has always been a pioneer, and we're very proud of it.
Lead paint, calorie count, fluoride, New York goes, the nation's followed. Things much more current as well. The little town of Richmond, California, just outside San Francisco, housing crisis, a lot of underwater homes there, and foreclosure threats. And the local government threatening eminent domain to come in, take these, and make their own deals. Here's an interview, Gail McLaughlin, member of the Green Party there, mayor of Richmond, California. This is with Democracy Now! Last month.
So we call on the banks to voluntarily sell us these loans, and if they don't cooperate, we will be considering eminent domain. Again, paying them fair market value.
The local mayor making housing policy, yes, and it comes to health and fitness, too. Here's North Richland Hills, Texas Mayor Oscar Trevino introduced a health and fitness initiative, and here's students from the Holiday Heights Elementary School singing their song in honor of the mayor's initiative. Okay, even the kids singing about the mayor has a first name, O-S-C-A-R. All over the place, there are initiatives. My guest today say this is where the action is. Brian in Canton, Ohio. Brian, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I see this all over the place, especially on the state level when it comes to gun laws, abortion, the marijuana law in Colorado and Washington. It just seems like it serves as a testament that lots of times what works locally and regionally is a lot better than actual blanket federal legislation. And to be honest with you, I think a lot of it stems from different regions and localities being tired of waiting for Washington to get something done.
But Brian, how far down can you take that to the local level? I mean, you take it from federal to state, but how effective do you think those kinds of changes can really be when you take it right on down to locality or networks of localities?
I think they can be extremely effective. I mean, I guess if you took it even farther, a little bit up from state, even county, get commissioners involved and start legislating for counties and things like that against necessarily what the federal government thinks is right for the entire country. If you look east, west, north, south, and different regions of the United States, there's extremely different cultures that blanket legislation just doesn't necessarily work for.
And Brian, in Ohio, I appreciate your call. Benjamin Barber, if I may come to you, you know, is there a, I don't know if there's an ideal model here. Is the ideal model that we would not have gridlock in Washington, federal government would be working very well with state and local, or are you suggesting it's actually better to have policy get made locally and then go where it will?
Well, I think the two things. One is the reality. The fact is, local is where it is happening, not federal. I mean, there are a variety of reasons that have to do with the ideological gridlock, that have to do with the bias of the federal government electorally towards rural regions that are a minority population, which end up in the Senate and elsewhere dominating the urban regions that have a majority of people. So there are a lot of things going on there. The fact is, it's not happening nationally, not just in this country, in a lot of other places, and it is happening locally. But let me say something about the word local. You've used it a lot, and it kind of sounds like we're saying the parochial, the local.
No, and on the contrary, local's got so much luster on it these days.
Well, but local also, the word I love is glocal, because local and global are deeply knit together in the modern world. It's the nation that is neither dealing with the global problems we face, the problems of an interdependent world, the challenges of climate change and global markets and so on, and cities, which are local, are also through their networks together dealing with global problems. So I like to think of cities as venues of locality where neighbors can address their common problems locally, but also together with cities working together can begin to deal with some of the global problems that states have been so bad at doing. It's an interesting change because in the 19th and 20th century, the avatar of the universal was the nation state. The nation state pushed civil rights, pushed national norms against the parochialism of localities. But today, it's often, as your caller just said, localities that are innovating, localities and cities that, as happened in San Francisco, that are pushing for gay marriage, that are pushing for breakthroughs. Richard Florida, the great urbanist, has said that cities are always the most innovative, creative, entrepreneurial parts of our society. So you can expect innovation and forward thinking from cities, and that's what they're doing.
We've got a lot of listeners responding to this. Matthew says, along your lines, Benjamin says, think globally, act locally, right? Joey says, 21st century leaders are moving past the 20th century organizational thinking and patterns, perhaps your nation state framing there, Benjamin, with its theories from the 19th century, and maybe that means local. Muffy says, mayors have always been the innovators because local policy doesn't usually neatly break down into simplistic left-right paradigms for the shallow talk show host lemmings. Okay. Jennifer, are there some kinds of localities in which this works better than others? I mean, after all, we also see some disastrous urban situations in this country where clearly they're not fixing or perhaps even addressing their problems. Start with Detroit and move from there.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Detroit because in the book Metropolitan Revolution, we actually talk about Detroit as an example of a community that's doing great things. The strength of metropolitan areas, again, I keep saying this over and over, is that their networks and what
Detroit
that
is
means
bankrupt.
Is,
if that's great, then what? I don't understand.
Well, right, but that's why you got to let me finish the story, which is so the city government is bankrupt, but within Detroit, there is an incredibly robust group of philanthropists, of civic actors, of business leaders who are making literally billions of dollars of investments in the midtown to downtown corridor. And they are creating in that Midtown-Downtown corridor what we call an innovation district, which will draw on a lot of the incredible advances that are happening at the College for Creative Studies, at Wayne State University, at Henry Ford Hospital, and some of the other healthcare institutes there, connecting that with entrepreneurship, with technology and business incubators, drawing more, as I said, more private capital, creating a rail line that's going to connect downtown and midtown. They are focusing on reviving kind of the core of the central city. They're doing this while the city government is, let's say, distracted at best. So the power of cities and networks is that the powers of cities and metros is that because they're networks, when one node of the network goes down, right, when the mayor is unable to address particular challenges, or you have a sui generis situation like Detroit, which, you know, is undergoing bankruptcy, that doesn't shut down the whole system. These other actors can come in and say, we can pick up the ball. We can create jobs. We can continue to build on what's good and what's strong and what works here. That's why we put Detroit in the book, because there's a lot of interesting stuff happening, even in the absence of a city government that provides most of the regular services that people have come to
Look,
expect.
Look, I like the sound of that, and I salute that effort, and I wish them well. But let's drill in a little bit here. I mean, Detroit rose to prosperity in its heyday. On an American capacity to educate, to export, labor mobility, advantageous trade circumstances, a lot of those things disappeared. I mean, can it really build back on the back of local initiative without a national/global environment that is somehow supportive of it?
Well, the Detroit region actually is still very export intense. The assets of the Detroit region around invention, around design, around connections to global markets and global supply chains, those are still there, as are 700,000 people.
Pasture land in Detroit, in the city of
Detroit. That's right. It's never going to be the city of almost 2 million people that it was. But it's still a city of 700,000 people.
Yeah.
That's not nothing. And their dreams and aspirations still count for something, and they still have a way to express themselves, because there are these other – that bankruptcy is not the only story of Detroit. America's cities and metropolitan areas are actually more resilient than that, and I think Detroit is more resilient than that. I don't think it will come back overnight, but I think over the course of a couple of decades, people will tell a very different story about Detroit. And it's because of the strength of these networks, of the Kresge Foundation, of the New Economy Initiative for Southeast Michigan, of the Ford Foundation, of groups like Midtown Detroit Inc., like the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation, investors like Dan Gilbert's Rock Ventures. Jobs are actually moving into the city.
Yeah, no, I get it, but we've seen the mile after mile of trouble there. Benjamin, I hear you there.
Yeah, I am. Let me say, because Jennifer's exactly right, and I'm glad you focused on Detroit, because always people jump to Detroit. You know, I say mayor should rule the world. They say, you mean Anthony Weiner? We say cities are in good shape, and people say Detroit. But the fact is, Detroit is a victim of two circumstances which has nothing to do with the city. One is, of course, the decline of American manufacturing and the automobile industry, which has affected many, many so-called Rust Belt cities, and Detroit is on the cusp of that. But much more importantly, Detroit is a victim of 19th century boundary drawing, when the city boundaries of our great American cities were first drawn, in which you demarcated a very limited area. If you mean by Detroit, specifically Detroit as defined by its city limits, Detroit is in deep trouble. If you mean by Detroit, as you should mean, and as should be reflected economically and legally, the 10 counties around Detroit, which are metropolitan, the greater Detroit metropolitan region, they are in incredibly good shape. Detroit has gone down from 2 million to 700,000. But in the meantime, the 10 counties around it that are Greater Detroit have gone from 3 to 5 million. Greater Detroit is now the number 4 new economy neighborhood region.
So you want to let those boundaries bleed out?
Silicon Valley, after San Francisco, and after New York. And it is thriving. One of the problems is that we have we have, in effect, imprisoned cities in 19th century limits and paid no attention to the greater metropolitan regions that they serve, yeah, no, that are their tax base.
I get that, but are you saying, Benjamin, you'd like to see sort of nation states, like a bunch of little Singapores, give them more range and let them make their...
No, I am saying simply, let's give a legal and economic definition to cities mm-hmm. that corresponds to the peoples they serve, the economy yeah. that they manifest, and so on. And if you do that, many of the problems we face today in some of the old cities disappear, because, in fact, in even the automobile industry, by the way, most of it, there's a few, there's a Jeep plant in downtown Detroit, in North Jefferson and so on, but most of the revival of the automobile industry is in the counties around
yeah,
Detroit.
We've got it.
Not reflected in Detroit.
We've got it. Ben in Newport, New Hampshire. Ben, you're on the air.
Hi. The automobile industry has been reborn in the South. No union, low regulation, and that's what's killed the cities, not the demise of the auto industry. It's doing just great with its low regulation, and they can work without the government bothering them. But what I wanted to call about is the typical example she gave first about New York is so liberal. You know, we'll spend $130 million, and over 20, 30 years, we'll get $30 billion. It's, you get these jobs on paper. It's not, they're not real. You know, yeah, they're going to come. Well, maybe, maybe not. It's just, you know, and believe me, I'm the biggest fan of local control, and a lot of it's the government pushing
yeah.
stuff down on us. Like Boeing wanted to move south, and Obama tried to block them from moving south. You know, just that micromanagement from Washington is not good. But, you know, tell me again Detroit's so great. Tell me Chicago's so great. You know, it's the liberal micromanaging of everybody's lives, and New York's going to head south if they elect a Democratic mayor that wants to redistribute wealth. The wealth is going to leave New York.
But Ben, let me ask you, you say you like local control, but then when that control is exercised, is that what you're calling liberal micromanagement?
Well, that's what's happened in Chicago. Look at Chicago. Look at Detroit.
Yeah, but what is local control if it's not local control? I mean, that's what
they've done it. That's fine. And these guys are saying that's great. It's worked. It works. It doesn't work if, you know, it all depends if the control
yeah.
is, you know, sometimes the best control is letting entrepreneurs do their thing. And that's not what's happening inside these cities.
Yeah, we've got it. Jennifer, what do you say to Ben's plaint?
To focus on the issue of entrepreneurship, there's actually a lot of entrepreneurship and it happening in these cities. We have this idea in the United States that an entrepreneur sits in, almost an enclosed, quiet room, and an idea just comes to him or her out of the blue. In fact, entrepreneurs need ecosystems. Entrepreneurs need people who know how to finance their ideas. They need people who know how to make prototypes of their ideas. They need people who know about all of the different kinds of public and private support programs for entrepreneurs. They find those things usually in cities and metropolitan areas. They find those things in business incubators like the Tech Town Business Incubator in Detroit, like the business incubators that the government of New York has set up. So what governments do really well in high-functioning cities and metropolitan areas is create an environment that brings together the people with the ideas, the people with the technical know-how, the people who can finance it. That's the gift of the city, and that's why entrepreneurs tend to flourish in cities.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about cities, towns, and mayors as the new pioneers of American public policy, shaping, reshaping how we live and doing it locally. Local is the big word of our decade, it seems. My guests today say, look at policy as well. Look at social and economic policy. Jennifer Bradley is co-author with Bruce Katz of The Metropolitan Revolution, How Cities and Metros Are Fixing Our Broken Politics and Fragile Economy. Benjamin Barber's forthcoming book is If Mayors Ruled the World, Dysfunctional Nations, Rising Cities. We have certainly seen for more than a little while now, cities getting right in the middle and localities
of policy, not just economic, but social and cultural as well. Here's a press conference, August 12, 2004, San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom speaking out in support of same-sex marriage after California's court's decision to nullify 4,000 licenses his city had almost 10 years ago now issued that year.
One of the things that I'm so proud of about San Francisco is that people of this city supported the decision we made, supported the actions we took, supported our advancements in humanity, our advancements in human dignity, by recognizing that it is fundamentally wrong in this country, fundamentally wrong in this city, to deny people equal protection under the law.
There's the cultural, the social side. Economic, here's Chicago's Mayor Rahm Emanuel. This was in March with Chicago's WGN-TV sharing his vision for Chicago's Neighborhoods Now, an initiative aimed at improving neighborhoods, standard of living, job creation.
What we're making in transportation, mass transit, road improvements, water improvement, bike lanes, parks, schools, this is going to leverage thousands upon thousands of construction jobs, as well as about $153 million in public investments, which will leverage another $800 million in private dollars.
Our caller before the break says, well, how much of that actually turns out? Well, it does turn out in any number of circumstances. Of course, nothing's guaranteed, but we're looking. We're paying close attention. Mayors, join us this hour. What are you up to? What are you up against? And can we rebuild this country from the ground up with local leadership? Ethan, in Harrisonburg, Virginia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
As I'm thinking about this dialogue, one of the things that comes to my mind is, for better or worse, we need cities. And we need cities to continue to be economic engines. Cities have provided the locomotion for nation states, for empires, for even for just city states as of themselves. And I'm thinking big picture here.
Like what examples are you thinking of? Sounds like you're going historical.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
I'm thinking of Rome, Carthage. They provided the economic engine for those respective empires. I think of Tyre and Constantinople, even more recently, the Italian city-states, Florence, Venice, Padua, the German city-states, and the best modern examples, Shanghai, Hong Kong.
Yeah, yeah.
Cities are a vital part of any nation.
Well, no question. And you point out what giant spark plugs they've been. I appreciate that, Ethan. Benjamin Barber, I mean, it is true, though, that we, of course, cities matter, but we've come to think of them as quite subsidiary. But Ethan points out that historically they've been central, maybe even the leader. Are you describing an evolution somehow toward that again? Is that possible, Benjamin, after our long nation-state sort of euphoric embrace?
Well, that's exactly the big story that political philosophers and historians tell. An ancient world in which men and women were born into cities, in which cities were our primary political institutions, succeeded by an era of empires and monarchies, and eventually nation-states, where democracy became representative instead of direct. We lost touch with government. We dealt with large-scale societies. And then today, where cities, which, by the way, are the same cities that were here 2,000 years ago, unlike the nation-states, yeah, which were only a couple hundred years old. Very interestingly, almost every city in the world is older than the state that it's a part of. And it is that cities have come back. We've kind of traversed now from the old polis to the new cosmopolis, a world in which cities are once again vitally important. Jennifer and Bruce talk about the Silk Road. Both of us talk about the Hanseatic League, which in the 10th century,
Germans,
the,
yeah,
cities that cooperated together. And today, by the way, there's a new Hansa League, in which cities along the North Sea in about a dozen countries are once again cooperating across borders. So it's not just that cities are taking the leadership inside their societies, but through global networks, they're beginning to again to work together the way they did in the ancient world to solve problems, global problems, that states aren't solving. So there's no question that cities today have a new lease on life. Part of that, by the way, is demographic. For the first time a couple of years ago in history, UN Habitat reported that over half of the human population live in cities. And in the Western world, it's about 78%. So the fact is, an awful lot of human beings, more and more and more, are living in cities. It's where we are. It's where we need to be governed. It's where problems have to be solved. And that is what cities are doing. So that historical perspective that Ethan provided for us is absolutely vital and reminds us that cities aren't just the new innovators, but are the original innovators.
But what about...
Glaser made a point. He said, we are an urban species.
Yeah.
We're by nature urban. I think that's really true.
But what about the tensions then with the nation states, which have been the big vehicle for more than a century now? I mean, are nation states making room for this, or is there...
But they're going to have to. They're going to have to make room. Here's the deal. Cities in the ancient world were on too small a scale to deal with the growing problems of territory and nations as they grew up in the 15th and 16th century. So you might say the ancient polis expired as a result of not being up to the scale of the problems as we came out of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. But
and now?
Today, the scale of the world, of global problems, of an interdependent world, of terrorism, of global markets, of ecology, are such that nation states are no longer up to the scale. And what we are seeing is not just cities coming back on locally, but networks of cities beginning to deal globally with the challenges that nation states are no longer up to. So that, ironically, it's localism that becomes the global solution to global problems through this new locality, this new cooperation of cities, this new network of cities. Bruce and Jennifer in their book talk a lot about these city networks. So do I. I like to call these networks like UCGLA or ECLA the most important institutions in the world nobody's ever heard of, because they are literally operative, efficient inner-city networks dealing with carbon pollution, dealing with transportation, dealing with immigration in ways that few people are aware of, but that are deeply important. It's not just the U.S. Conference of Mayors or the Mexican Conference of Mayors. It's global city associations.
Oh, it sounds empowering to bring it down to that level and then network. Jennifer in Duluth, Minnesota, thank you for joining us. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for this intriguing conversation. I do live just outside of Duluth, Minnesota. I do a lot of my work there, and it's the furthest inland international port in the world. We're right on Lake Superior, and it's a huge hub of historical industry, and still today, but we have a very active and well-connected mayor, Mayor Don Ness, and he is actively seeking collaborations with local initiatives like the Duluth Community Garden Program and a community action Duluth to improve the local food system, to provide more comprehensive and interconnected and accessible food systems for everyone in the city. I think it's also with the work of local leaders and even regional, like our county, our St. Louis county, and our great late county commissioner, Steve O'Neill, who studied the humanitarian studies and were social leaders and inspiring, connected directly to the people of the community.
But Jennifer, let me ask you, Jennifer, you're there in Duluth. Do you feel confidence that you can pull off whatever it is that you need in Duluth locally, or, you know, do you have to have national help, state help? How much of it your challenge set can you meet locally?
Well, I think so many people think of Duluth and how far north we are, how cold it is, and think when they think of the local food movement, they're like, oh, well, we could never possibly produce enough of our own food. But actually, historically, we can. We know that we can, and there's lots of research and models showing that we can.
Yep.
I mean, we're all going to have to change our diet eventually to be sustainable, but we can produce enough food here. And I think that food really is the corner point or the center point of the issues of sustainability, because we all have to eat, and if we don't eat, that's really what the problem comes down to.
Jennifer, we've got it, and yet certainly it's funny how locavore food and the food on our plate becomes a kind of metaphor that gets a lot of people encouraged about all kinds of local solutions. I appreciate your call from Duluth, Jennifer. One right here from Canandaigua, New York. Gloria, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is a great program. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Right here in Canandaigua, New York, one of the things that is happening is that with our local town government, is that we, as a group, got together, talked with our, you know, our supervisors, and we have a moratorium against hydrofracking. We do not want it. And many, many other local small communities in New York State have done the same thing.
Does that have power? Can the company just go to the state?
It does.
It does?
In fact, there were two areas. We're still fairly new here. But yeah. Anyway, Dryden, I think, was one that banned hydrofracking. And the oil and gas companies, you know, tried to bring them to court and everything. It's going back and forth, but the way the law is, they have the right to ban something like that on their land.
So there's
and we will too.
Yep, communities stepping up to saying this is the way we want to have it. Gloria, forgive me, our time is short here. I can hear that tension. Taking action locally, but you've still got real challenges from national or global corporations, at the very least. Jennifer, what about in the big campaigns that are going on right now? Right here in Boston, New York, across the country, Houston, Seattle, mayoral campaigns. Can you hear the sound of this new sense of empowerment or local responsibility being reflected in the campaigns, Jennifer?
Absolutely. I think that people... mayors are excited to feel like their job is bigger than ever. Mayors are excited to say it's more than just potholes and garbage pickup. A mayor's job now, you know, as Benjamin has been saying so eloquently, is to step up on the international stage and connect Boston or Houston or Seattle to its peer cities, its network of trading cities. A mayor's job is also to connect nationally so that mayors can get together, as they did under the leadership of former Mayor Villaraigosa of Los Angeles, who's already been mentioned, when they changed transportation policy to make it easier to build smart kinds of rail systems in their communities. They changed federal law so that it met the needs of local places more than the needs of federal bureaucracies. Mayors need to network within their metropolitan regions so that those borders, the kinds of borders that have choked off so much of Detroit, mm-hmm. become less important when mayors work together at a municipal level. So I think it is a very exciting time now for people who want to be mayors because they understand the incredible weight of responsibility and the incredible potential. They understand that the eyes of the nation, if not the world, are on them and that they can learn so much from their peers and from organizations like ICLEI and other international things. So I think for people who really want to make a difference at the local level, make a difference anywhere, the local level is probably where they will come to bring their ambitions, right? If you look at what Rahm Emanuel did, he walked away from the highest levels of the federal government
the White House.
To become mayor of Chicago.
Yeah.
And he says that being mayor of Chicago is the best job he's had in public life. I think that's because mayors understand that it's an enormous responsibility, but there's so much potential there.
A gridlock in Washington, mayors, cities and towns looking to pick it up, and yet the interest rate gets set in Washington and a whole lot more. Tom in New Haven, Kentucky. Tom, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling with a question. I just wanted to put this question on the table. How much is this local movement a local way to interact with the global world? And how much is it almost a fundamentalist economic perspective and a rejection of globalization?
That's interesting. There's been kind of the presumption running through our conversation, Benjamin, that this meant, a sort of a metropolitan, cosmopolitan view of the world. It's not necessarily so. What about cities and towns that might go the other way, sort of put the walls up, Benjamin?
Well, it is necessarily so, actually. It's necessarily so because we live in a necessarily interdependent world of ecological interdependence, of war and peace interdependence, of trade and immigration interdependence. We don't live – towns were walled in the Middle Ages, but ever since then they've stretched out their 90% of them on rivers and water.
We've got walled communities all over this country. It is not uncommon.
They connect So you can't solve these problems, even if you wanted to, by building a wall. That's why New York, that's why Stuttgart in Germany, that's why Shanghai, despite the Chinese authoritarian government, reach out to other cities because they know they can't do it alone. You come back to the locality to get started, but you realize you cannot solve global problems of transportation, of immigration, of ecology, without working with others. So it's a compulsory cosmopolitanism. There is something parochial about localism, but the fact is, once you set about solving problems, mayors, city councils, and the citizens of cities realize they can't do it alone. They have to do it again together. And one of the things that happens, and this is fundamental, we haven't mentioned it, I want to just quickly mention it, and that is that the trust levels for cities, the democracy of cities, we live in an America where democracy is in crisis. There's so much cynicism about what's going on in Washington and with the ideological gridlock. But interestingly, while 14% of Americans approve of the Congress and maybe 40% of the president and 42% of the Supreme Court, 70 to 75% of Americans still trust their mayors. There's a sense that democracy can still work in cities. Cities can still be participatory. You've got participatory planning, participatory budgeting, citizens directly involved. That's, after all, the neighborhoods where people live. So democracy holds out the hope of actually working in cities, and that's a great thing for a country where, especially among young people, people have gotten so cynical and dispirited about the possibilities of democracy. So I think cities are forced to be cosmopolitan, like it or not. They are democratic, and they hold out an optimism and hope that the system can work despite ideological gridlock at the nation. That's not to say that you're not right. Obviously, there are plenty of tensions. There are plenty of problems. Courts will go after city decisions in Pittsburgh.
Benjamin, we're out of time right there. Look for the book, If Mayors Ruled the World, and Jennifer Bradley's The Metropolitan Revolution. Thanks to you both. This is On Point.